The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. On the last episode, Palestine is erupting in the British struggle to maintain control. While the Jewish economy rapidly develops, the Falahin move to the cities as wage laborers in greater numbers. Working-class Palestinians and Middle Eastern Jews cohabitate in mixed cities, but the political struggle between the Zionist settlers and the Palestinian masses is becoming increasingly vicious. The efforts to mediate between European Jews and the non-Jewish Palestinians are failing as Palestinian capital looks to Europe for an ally against the British and Jews. Suddenly, the Palestinian masses rise up and rapidly build a sustained long-term rebellion. The Haganah align themselves with the British to put down an indigenous uprising as the Yishuv begins making preparations for a mass transfer of Palestinians out of Palestine. Zionist strategy of collaborating and fighting against the British at the same time is starting to pay off. With that, I bring you the fourth and final part of the colonization of Palestine, Catastrophe. Throughout the late 70s and 80s, British journalist Robert Fisk traveled to Lebanon to report on the civil war there. Fisk details encounters with aging Palestinian men and women who longed to return to their homes so close and yet so far away. These were the people who had fled Palestine during the establishment of the State of Israel. Refugee camps were established in nearby countries, including Lebanon. Rusted keys were the only remaining possessions of their former lives, used to lock the entrances of homes. For some, these keys were bitter reminders of the temporary situation that became permanent. For others, the keys were preserved with great care, along with documents proving legal ownership over their long-lost properties in towns that no longer existed. In some cases, these towns existed under new Hebraicized names. Maps, deeds, even tax returns, featuring the seal of the long-gone Ottoman Empire. In the words of Fisk, quote, "The keys, often made of thick gray iron, sometimes with decorated handles, were in a sense a promise of return, a promise that history inevitably broke. The new owners of those homes forbade any return and then changed the lock." Unquote. Robert Fisk traveled to the former village of al-Faraj in northern Israel, a mere 15 miles away from the camp where he interviewed a refugee who had fled during the Nakba. Literally translated as the catastrophe known to Israelis as their war of independence, but to Palestinians as the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. What should have been a 25-minute car ride over the border instead took Fisk to Greece, to Tel Aviv, and then a 4-hour car ride, nearly a 1,000-mile round trip. In another trip to Jaffa, the once mixed city in modern-day Israel, Fisk visited the former home of a refugee named Ibrahim Abu Khadra. On the second floor, he met and interviewed a Turkish-born Jew and former neighbor. Fisk writes, quote, "He well remembered Ibrahim Abu Khadra. He was a nice enough man," David said. "But we saw little of him in 1948. This house was part of the Jewish front line, and although Mr. Abu Khadra never knew it, we had guns and ammunition stored downstairs. Menachem Begin used to come here during the 1948 battles to this house, and he came up to see us 3 or 4 times during the fighting to have coffee and biscuits with us. He was a good and agreeable man." The resident of the first floor unit admitted that Ibrahim had lived there once, but declined to be interviewed. Unquote. On another trip to Jerusalem, Fisk interviewed Israeli government spokesman Rafi Horowitz. Fisk had conducted 35 interviews with refugees and just arrived from Lebanon. Fisk recounts his defensive explanation for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Quote, "You've got to realize that the state of Palestine never existed. The Arabs went to war with us in 1948 to destroy our Jewish state. Please excuse us for winning." Unquote. In less than the span of a lifetime, Palestine had gone from an Arab culture of Jews, Muslims, Christians, and other sects within to a fortress state of Jewish hegemony, with an Arab minority under military rule. What started as a small fledgling movement of Jewish European intellectuals had successfully formed a tumultuous but critical alliance with the British within a few decades, building a proto-state in the form of the Yeshuv and laying the groundwork for the establishment of the Jewish state. They had largely accomplished this by appealing to British prejudice and religious fervor. Many British officials held the Holy Land in reverence and saw the Jews as their historical allies in securing the land of the Bible. Anti-Semitism had even aided the Zionist movement, as some British leaders treated Chaim Weizmann as though he were the, quote, king of the Jews, in the words of Tom Segev, a role Weizmann was happy to play. At the end of the day, however, the British were concerned with British affairs above all others. And in the wake of the Arab Rebellion, the Brits were less inclined to believe in the all-powerful Jewish conspiracy. In 1939, the British announced a policy change in the form of the New White Paper. The British called for a Jewish national home to be established in an independent Palestinian state within 10 years, rather than a full partition. Jewish immigration was also limited to 75,000 per year for 5 years, and limits on land purchases were enacted. Palestinian opinion was split, while the Zionists were united in opposing the British White Paper. The revisionist Zionists began organizing a rebellion against the British while launching terror attacks on Palestinian civilians. Avraham Stern, soon to be the founder of the Lehi, organized and trained Jewish guerrillas in Poland, preparing them to participate in a revolt in Palestine. Shortly before the operation could begin, Poland was invaded by Germany and the Soviet Union. The European phase of World War II had begun. In response to the dual enemy of Nazi Germany and the White Paper, David Ben-Gurion declared, quote, "We will fight the White Paper as if there is no war, and fight the war as if there is no White Paper," unquote. The Zionists threw their support towards Britain against Germany. Even the revisionists temporarily halted their terror campaign against the Brits. A small number of revisionists broke away from the Irgun to form their own militant organization, Lochamei Harut Yisrael, the Lehi, also known as the Stern Gang. Meanwhile, the Middle Eastern Jews of Palestine, including Mizrahi, Sephardic, and Yemeni Jews, were undergoing dramatic demographic and generational changes. For decades, Arabic-speaking Jews of the Middle East acted as mediators and lived lives in proximity with both Palestinians and the Zionist settlers. However, the 30s had taken a toll on the goodwill of Arabic-speaking Jews. As the conflict became more zero-sum, violence against Jews distinguished less between Zionist settlers and the Middle Eastern Jews of Palestine and nearby Arab regions. Increasingly, younger generations of these Jews became resentful of the violence. At the same time, the refusal of the Zionist leadership to provide Middle Eastern Jews with real influence in the movement led to a further split between these Jews and their non-Jewish neighbors. Denied positions of political leadership, these Jews were welcomed into propaganda efforts and eventually recruited heavily into the intelligence service of the British and the Yeshuv. Jacobson and Naor describe the phenomenon. Quote, "In the history of the Haganah, which represents the views of Israeli historiography in the 1950s and 60s, Yehuda Slutsky explains that those chosen to commit terrorist actions among the Arabs were, in most cases, young men who knew Arabic from the Oriental Jewish communities, who would dress themselves in the style of Arab peasants, enter Arab streets while walking innocently, place the bomb, and then attempt to return to the Jewish area." Faithful to the perspective of the labor Zionist movement, Slutsky goes on to explain that most of these youths were very young and had prepared for their dangerous mission by protracted education in Beitar and by the romanticism of the underground. Unquote. Jacobson and Naor describe a number of bombing operations committed by Middle Eastern Jews dressed in Arab-style clothing, blending into Arab communities both in Palestine as well as in Iraq. The dual force of Palestinian violence and Zionist refusal to look at the Middle Eastern Jews as little more than intelligence assets, assassins, and covert militants diminished the possibilities of mediation. In turn, the political influence of these communities was diminished outside of the intelligence and military sphere. Quote, "The identification of Sephardi and Oriental Jews with the revisionist movement and of Oriental Jews with the Irgun's terrorist operations weakened the status of the Sephardi leadership and portrayed it as a secessionist force and a partner in efforts to challenge the authority of the national institutions. The involvement of Oriental youth in the Irgun's terrorist operations brought the Sephardi leadership into conflict not only with Mapai, but also with the British Mandatory Government. Unquote. The Zionist factions, while seeing the British as the enemy, were generally willing to cooperate and align their interests against common enemies, such as the Palestinians or the Axis powers. This brought them international sympathy from the Allied nations. But the increasingly dire conditions in Europe, soon to be confirmed rumors of a systemic extermination of Jews, added a new dimension of urgency to the methods and means utilized by the Zionists. Throughout the war, British policy restricted Jewish immigration to Palestine, diverting ships of refugees to camps on the Mediterranean islands of Mauritius and Cyprus, where they would remain in camps until after the establishment of the State of Israel. In response, the various Zionist armed factions began to target and disrupt British infrastructure, planting explosives on ships ferrying Jews to British camps and bombing government offices related to immigration. The effects of increasingly militant actions taken by all armed Zionist factions led to civilian deaths, including that of the refugees attempting to flee the Nazis in some cases. In November 1940, Haganah sappers miscalculated the explosives needed to disable a ship, killing 252 of the Jewish refugees aboard. The Zionists justified their actions in response to increasing reports of mass extermination of Jews in Europe. Nazi Germany had placed anti-Semitism at the center of its crusade against communists and Jews. No longer a mere fringe nationalist party of violent gangs in the 1920s, the Nazis were now firmly in control of much of European industry and blitzkrieging through the continent. By Germany's defeat in 1945, 6 million Jews were dead, along with millions of communists, Romani, disabled people, queer folk, and other undesirables. The Zionists were spurred to action in response to the development of the Nazi Holocaust. However, the movement prioritized the building of a Jewish state above all other concerns. Benny Morris quotes David Ben-Gurion speaking shortly after the Kristallnacht pogrom against Jews in Germany. Quote, "If I knew it was possible to save all the Jewish children of Germany by transfer to England and only half of them by transferring them to Eretz Yisrael, I would choose the latter, because we are faced not only with the accounting of these children, but also with the historical accounting of the Jewish people." Unquote. As late as 1942, when the extermination of Jews in Europe became undeniable in public record, Ben-Gurion stated, quote, "The catastrophe of European Jewry is not, in a direct manner, my business." Unquote. Tom Segev adds, quote, "The restriction on immigration levied a price in human life, but the White Paper's role in the Holocaust is, in the end, relatively small. In the summer of 1941, Chaim Weizmann estimated that when the war ended, it would take 20 years to bring in 1.5 million Jews to Palestine. Ben-Gurion argued that 3 million could be brought in 10 years. Palestine, then, was not the solution for the Jewish people. The only way to save them and millions of non-Jews was war." Unquote. Zionist resistance to British policy did have the effect of creating negative public opinion towards British policy, including within the United States, which had become more sympathetic to the Zionist cause. Despite this complicated relationship with the British, the Haganah and Irgun leadership decided to oppose the British White Paper immigration policy, but also fight with the British against Axis powers upon the outbreak of World War II. The Zionist movement contributed volunteers to a Jewish brigade that saw combat against Germans in Italy. The Yishuv gained valuable military experience. The Arab governments, including the Husseini-dominated Palestinian political leadership, offered political support to the Axis powers, hoping for a weakened British Empire. Meanwhile, the major Zionist leaders began to plan for a post-war era. Chaim Weizmann, writing in 1942 for Foreign Affairs magazine, openly called for a Jewish state in all land west of the Jordan River. By 1942, the Yishuv adopted the Biltmore program, demanding the establishment of a Jewish state. For the duration of the war, most Zionist militias and militants fought alongside the British, gaining valuable military experience and continuing to garner sympathy from the world. Tens of thousands of Jews returned to Palestine with modern military training and combat experience. The Haganah had also illegally purchased or stolen arms from a massive British stockpile in Palestine and Egypt. The British also trained an elite Haganah unit in commando and guerrilla tactics. This mobile strike force became known as the Palmach, a crack military unit meant for rapid defensive and offensive operations. The Palestinian political leadership was still in exile, and little political or military development occurred in Palestine during the war. No more than a few thousand Palestinians gained military experience during this time. Haj Amin al-Husseini spent the war in exile throughout Europe and the Middle East, collaborating with the Nazis and organizing attacks against Allied targets and Jewish populations. World War II ended in 1945. In the wake of the Nazi Holocaust, approximately 250,000 survivors of the death camps were now refugees, classified as displaced persons in camps located in Germany, Austria, and Italy. The sheer scale of the extermination of Jews shocked the world, even though rumors and accounts were known within Jewish communities well before mainstream news coverage and Allied governments began to publicly acknowledge it in 1942. During the Yalta Conference towards the end of the war, American President Franklin Delano Roosevelt described himself as a Zionist to Joseph Stalin. After FDR's death, President Truman announced his support for resettling DPs in Palestine. The Jewish Agency proposed a measure to immediately resettle 100,000 DPs in Palestine with Truman's support. The White Paper's annual quota had expired. The new British government proposed 1,500 a month. As the war approached its end, the revisionist Zionist militia, the Irgun, now under the leadership of future Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, resumed their struggle against the British. They attacked or bombed government offices and police stations, deciding that the war against Germany had already been won, and the British were to be harassed and weakened while still distracted by years of world war. The Lehi, a small but radical offshoot of the Irgun, had never given up on armed struggle against the British, though their activities were heavily restricted for the early years of the world war. The Haganah and its new crack paramilitary branch, the Palmach, resumed their activities against the British only after the formal end of World War II. The relationships between these factions were on and off again, occasionally cooperating on militant activities, sometimes staying out of each other's way, and sometimes fighting against each other, with the Haganah sometimes collaborating with the British against the Irgun Olehi. By October 1945, the three major armed Zionist factions had signed a pact together and launched the Hebrew Rebellion Movement. The Palmach were the first to strike, attacking a British detention camp and freeing 208 undocumented Jewish immigrants on October 9th. Benny Morris writes, quote, "In November, Palmach sapper squads sabotaged railway tracks at 153 points around Palestine. A British patrol vessel was sunk, and in response, the capture of a ship carrying illegal immigrants by the Royal Navy, two British Coast Guard stations were blown up. The British responded with raids on several coastal plain settlements they suspected of harboring Haganah soldiers or illegal immigrants. The troops panicked and opened fire, killing 9 civilians and wounding 63. Anti-British emotions peaked. Periodically during the following months, the Haganah, Irgun, and Lehi attacked British targets. The most spectacular action was by the Palmach squads on the night of June 17, 1946. When 11 bridges connecting Palestine to Transjordan, Syria, Lebanon, and the Sinai were blown up simultaneously." Unquote. On July 22, 1946, the Irgun launched one of the most infamous attacks of terrorism in the era, bombing the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, killing 91 people, including Britons, Arabs, and Jews. The hotel housed administrative offices for the British military, though the entire wing was destroyed in the explosion. While the Haganah denounced the attack and dissolved the Hebrew resistance movement, the British were privately desperate for an exit from the situation. Britain's inability to find a political settlement to the Palestine question led the United States to break and declare partition as the official position of the Truman administration. Finally, the exhausted British handed over the fate of Palestine to the UN, possibly in a last-ditch effort to salvage their influence of the area by scaring the Zionists into compromise, but more likely due to weakened and demoralized British standing. The British, as Benny Morris writes, quote, could ill afford to alienate Washington over a highly emotional issue that, when all was said and done, was not a vital British interest. Unquote. British repression of Zionist sabotage, terror, and assassination operations never quite reached the same level of blanket state terror that was used during the Arab Rebellion. Palestinian judge Anwar Nusaba noted that the Jewish community near the site of the King David Hotel was not punished for the actions of the Irgun the same way that Palestinian neighborhoods were held responsible for Palestinian attacks on British targets. Tom Segev places the main reasons for this disparity as European chauvinism. Segev notes with some shock, quote, incredibly, but perhaps typical of the confusion that marked Britain's Palestine policy, in at least one case the Haganah received informal permission from the administration to carry out an attack against it. Richard Crossman, Labour MP and a great friend of Zionism, told the Undersecretary of War for Air, John Strachey, that the Haganah was considering blowing up a bridge over the Jordan River. He requested advice. Strachey, a member of the Cabinet Defense Committee, asked for time to look into the matter, and the next day gave Crossman his consent. Unquote. Elsewhere within the British-controlled Middle East, demonstrations against Zionism and British rule were held in Egypt, Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. In some cases, attacks against the local Jewish community broke out, with shops and synagogues destroyed, and in the case of Libya, approximately 100 Jews were murdered. The British struggled to keep order and placate one party without antagonizing the other. The campaign against the British would continue even as the international community conducted investigations and began to formulate a plan to address the Palestine question. The Yishuv engaged in diplomacy, allowing the activities of the Irgun and Lehi against the British while banning non-mainstream Zionists from communicating with the Anglo-American Committee of Inquiry. Here, the Zionist grasp of Western political thought and diplomacy paid off, making a strong case for their political aspirations. Western diplomats observed that the Zionists were creating a viable proto-state and culture, remarking disparagingly of Arab poverty and, in the words of a British committee member, R.H.S. Crossman, quote, the stenchiest Arab village, unquote, that he had ever seen. Morris quotes an American observer who described the Arab political approach as treating the committee to, quote, a sumptuous luncheon at Katie Antonius's or ceremonial visit to a large estate, rather than any systematic marshalling of facts and figures to make a convincing presentation, unquote. In 1947, after years of attacks on British targets by the Irgun, including spectacular mass casualty attacks or kidnappings and executions of British military, the UK handed the question of Palestine to the UN. Morris quotes a historian familiar with the British state archives, quote, the Irgun's draconian methods, morally reprehensible as they were decisive in transforming the evacuation option of February 1947 into a determined resolve to give up the burden of the mandate, unquote. Ultimately, the UN would vote for partition, offering two states for Jews and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians. The resolution was rejected by the Arabs and accepted by the Zionists, a fact that would form the beginning of the narrative of many contemporary accounts of Israeli history. It is true that the soon-to-be Israelis had agreed to a partition of land that, ideologically, they considered entirely their own. From this perspective, in which Jewish sovereignty over the whole of Palestine was their historical right, accepting 55% of the land was a significant compromise. But from the Palestinian perspective, the imperialist powers, acting through the United Nations, had granted 55% of Palestine to 37% of the population, a minority whose majority was mostly foreign, a settler colonial project financed by European capital. According to Palestinian historian Walid Khalidi, quote, the Palestinians failed to see why they should be made to pay for the Holocaust. They failed to see why it was fair for the Jews to be a minority in a unitary Palestinian state, while it was fair for almost half of the Palestinian population, the indigenous majority on its own ancestral soil, to be converted overnight into a minority under alien rule. Unquote. Within the confines of the Jewish state lay most of the citrus land, 80% of Syria land, and 40% of Palestinian industry. The Zionists were beneficiaries of a rare moment of consensus between the Western liberal and social democratic republics on one hand and the Soviet bloc on the other. But immediately, the Arab nations made their position known. The partition plan had no legitimacy, and conflict was inevitable. The Zionists began to make preparations for war. Now that the British were preparing to exit, the violence in Palestine took on a new dimension. Within days of the vote for partition, incidents around Palestine led to the deaths of Jews and Palestinians. From late November 1947 to mid-May 1948, Palestine was engulfed by a guerrilla-style civil war between Jews and Palestinians. The Haganah adopted a proactive military strategy, rejecting the balance-restrained strategy practiced in previous periods of violence. Benny Morris describes the hardened attitudes of the largest Jewish militia in Palestine. Quote, "Its reprisal raids tended to be disproportionate to the original Arab offense. This strategy tended to spread the conflagration to areas that had so far been untroubled by the hostilities. From the first, the Irgun and Lehi, and to a lesser degree the Haganah, used terror attacks against civilian and militia centers. The Arabs responded by planting large bombs in Jewish civilian centers, especially in Jerusalem." Unquote. Later he adds, quote, "The Irgun and Lehi, using terrorism against civilians, had a major hand in turning what were sporadic Arab riots and armed attacks into a bitter full-scale civil war." Unquote. Car bombs, bus bombings, building explosions, and the high civilian casualties led to reprisal attacks. Following these reprisals, a new strategy of inflicting disproportionate pain on the Palestinians gave birth to the first massacres of the new war. As spring of 1948 began, the Haganah shifted their strategy from defending and supplying Jewish enclaves towards the conquest of Palestinian communities. Yigael Yadin, Haganah Operations Chief and future IDF Chief of Staff, drafted a new strategy known as Plan Dalit, intended to solidify control of strategic areas as the British withdrew. The plan allowed for the evacuation and raising or mining of Palestinian communities. As the end of the British mandate approached, Zionist militias prepared to take as much ground and expel as many Palestinians as possible before the inevitable intervention of the Arab armies. Walid Khalidi describes statistical data on the preparations of the Zionist militias based on Hebrew sources. Quote, "By March 1948, the local Zionist factories in Palestine were producing 100 submachine guns per day, to be increased to 200 per day by the end of the first week of April, and 400,000 rounds of 9mm ammunition per month. Moreover, these factories were coping with the orders of the magnitude of 150,000 Mills grenades and 30,000 shells of 3-inch mortars. Indeed, the local Zionist factories were very resourceful. And, in addition to the Sten guns, 2-inch and 3-inch mortars and their ammunition, also produced flamethrowers, anti-tank guns, and a heavy mortar called the Davidka." Unquote. The Davidka gained special notoriety for its whistle and particularly loud explosion that would make up for its lack of accuracy and effectiveness by terrorizing both military and civilians on the receiving ends of its attack. What it lacked in combat usefulness, it made up for in terms of psychological warfare. Many of the weapons and munitions factories were built underground, below civilian infrastructure. By April 1948, Haganah and Palmach units took the war on the offensive. Between April 1st and May 15th, the Haganah and Palmach launched 13 operations to take strategic cities, towns, and roads. The majority of these operations sought to destroy Palestinian villages or expel their population. The majority of these operations occurred before the Arab armies had entered Palestine. The Palestinian resistance, while fierce, was mostly local and terribly coordinated. As far as formal organized armed militias during the civil war phase, the Palestinian numbers were small and under-equipped. The Zionist militias aimed to gain as much ground as possible before the Arab armies would enter Palestine. As before, the Irgun and Lehi conducted their own operations with or without the Haganah. The most famous of these operations, and one that included assistance from the Haganah, was the capture and massacre of the Palestinian village, Deir Yassin, located just a couple of miles outside of Jerusalem. Only a month earlier, residents of the village had refused to host the Arab Liberation Army, the best-equipped Arab force at the time, and had dissuaded the bands of Abd al-Qadir al-Husseini, one of the more organized Palestinian fighting formations, from attacking their Jewish neighbors in Givat Shaul. On April 9th, Irgun and Lehi units, backed by two Palmach squads, began an assault on Deir Yassin with Haganah machine gun support. Casualties were heavy, with more than a quarter of the Irgun and Lehi units wounded and five dead. They advanced through sniper fire, destroying homes by tossing grenades through the windows and dynamiting the buildings. What followed became known as the most infamous slaughter of the entire war. Benny Morris describes the murders committed by the Irgun and Lehi using reports from the Israeli military archives. Quote, "Whole families were riddled with bullets and grenade fragments and buried when houses were blown up on top of them. Men, women, and children were mowed down as they emerged from houses. Individuals were taken aside and shot. At the end of the battle, groups of old men, women, and children were trucked through West Jerusalem's streets in kind of a victory parade and then dumped in Arab East Jerusalem." Unquote. He continues, quote, "According to Jerusalem Shai Commander Levy, reporting on the 12th, the conquest of the village was carried out with great cruelty. Whole families, women, old people, children were killed, and there were piles of dead in various places. Some of the prisoners moved to places of incarceration, including women and children, were murdered viciously by their captors." In a report the following day, he added, "Lehi members tell of the barbaric behavior, hitna hagut, bara barabit, of the Irgun towards the prisoners and the dead. They also relate that the Irgun raped a number of Arab girls and murdered them afterwards. We don't know if this is true. The Shai operative who visited the site hours after the event, Mordechai Gichon, reported on April 10th. Their commander says that the order was to capture the adult males and to send the women and children to Motza. On the afternoon of April 9th, the order was changed and became to kill all the prisoners. The adult males were taken to the town in trucks and paraded in the streets before taken back to the site and killed with rifle and machine gun fire. Before they were put on the trucks, the Irgun and Lehi men searched the women, men, and children and took from them all the jewelry and stole their money. The behavior toward them was especially barbaric and included kicks, shoves with the rifle butts, spitting, and cursing. People from the western Jerusalem neighborhood of Givat Shaul took part in the torture." Unquote. Deir Yassin was not the only instance of Zionist terror. Yigal Alon, then a commander with the Palmach, launched a psychological warfare campaign on the residents of the Hula Valley. The threats of slaughter and rape, barely a month after the widely publicized Deir Yassin massacre, compelled the residents to flee for Lebanon and Syria without a fight. Right around the same time, the city of Jaffa, which had endured weeks of assaults by both Irgun and Haganah forces, surrendered to the Haganah. Only about 5% of the Palestinian population remained, most having fled weeks of house-to-house fighting and mortar barrages. A decade earlier, Ben-Gurion stated that he would not mourn on the day that Jaffa fell into hell. On May 18, 1948, Ben-Gurion would write in his diary, quote, "I couldn't understand. Why did the inhabitants leave?" Unquote. For decades, the specter of Deir Yassin loomed over the political careers of Menachem Begin and his fellow veterans turned politicians. Members of the Irgun and Lehi became two prime ministers of Israel and formed Harut, the main political opposition party from the right, which would eventually merge into the modern-day Likud party. For the labor Zionists who would dominate Israeli politics for the first few decades following the war, it was an effective political tool that portrayed the right wing as violent in contrast to the self-image of the labor Zionists as egalitarian, reluctant warriors. As a result, Deir Yassin became the Jewish atrocity that you were allowed to talk about. A few months before the conception of Plan Dalit, in the early morning of January 6, 1948, Khalil al-Sakakini woke to the loud noise of explosion. The Haganah had bombed the Semiramis Hotel in the Katamon neighborhood of Jerusalem. A team had snuck into the neighborhood in a late-night operation targeting militants headquartered at the hotel. As he did 31 years earlier on the night he took in Alter Levine, Sekakini wrote in his diary about the bombs exploding in his neighborhood. 24 hotel guests had been killed, including the Spanish consul. Despite attacks by multiple Zionist militias and terror squads, the Palestinians of Katamon were left to their own devices by the Arab armies. Segev writes, quote, "When Lehi agents penetrated Katamon and blew up several houses, Sekakini and his neighbors went to the Arab High Committee and demanded arms. There aren't any, they were told. The Katamon residents demanded guards. There aren't any of those either, they learned. Where are the trained volunteers? Sekakini wanted to know. Where is the money collected from all the Arab and Islamic countries? It occurred to him that he was witnessing the fulfillment of Proverbs 25:14. One who boasts of gifts that he does not give is like clouds and winds without rain." Unquote. In another story, Sekakini recalls hosting a commander by the name of Abd al-Qadir al-Husseini. In the midst of a siege by Jews, the Christian Sekakini felt compelled to advocate Islamic rules of war to the commander. Quoting the first Arab caliph, quote, "Thou shalt not kill a child, an old man, or a woman. Thou shalt not burn a tree nor destroy a house. Thou shalt not pursue one who flees, and thou shalt not mutilate bodies. Thou shalt not harm he who is occupied in the worship of God." Unquote. Segev notes that Husseini did not request further counsel. Sekakini often wrote of his frustration with the lack of support from the Arab High Committee, the theoretical proto-government of the Palestinians. Segev would describe these writings as, quote, "the history of the Arab defeat," unquote. The fighting continued in Katamon for months, with Palmach commander and future Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin playing an important role. Conditions deteriorated as the fighting became increasingly fierce. Residents were beginning to leave. On April 7th, Sekakini found a bullet in his balcony. Craters, fires, and smoke were a common sight. On April 13th, Sekakini wrote that they would leave the next day if they survived the night. 1 week later, Khalil al-Sekakini fled with his two daughters, leaving all their possessions at the home to which they planned to return. The Arab question had been answered. By the British evacuation and the declaration of the State of Israel on May 15th, the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, known as the Nakba, was well on its way. While some members of Ben-Gurion's cabinet argued for allowing, quote, "good Arabs" to remain under Jewish sovereignty in the new Jewish state, very few considered taking any significant measures to allow the refugees to return. In May 1948, an unofficial transfer committee was formed to manage the transfer of Palestinians and decide what to do with their property. Ezra Danin, a member of the committee, recommended that institutions such as charity organizations could prevent the return of refugees by securing their integration into the host countries they evacuated into. At the same time, Palestinian homes would be destroyed or handed over to Jews who would resettle the recently vacated land as soon as possible. On June 5th, the committee made a number of recommendations to Ben-Gurion. Quote, "Preventing the Arabs from returning to their places. 1. Extending help to the Arabs to be absorbed in other places. Regarding the first guideline, the committee proposed destruction of villages as much as possible during military operations. 2. Prevention of any cultivation of the land by them, i.e. the Arabs, including reaping, collection of crops, picking olives, and so on. 3. Settlement of Jews in a number of villages and towns so that no vacuum is created. 4. Enacting legislation geared to barring a return. 5. Making propaganda aimed at non-return." Unquote. Destruction of Palestinian property began before Ben-Gurion was informed. He retroactively approved of most of the committee's recommendations. Declining to approve an official transfer committee, he retroactively approved most of the committee's recommendations. Yosef Weitz, a member of the committee, noted that Ben-Gurion was careful committing these discussions to paper. Weitz's side of the paper trail confirms these discussions. Morris adds, quote, "No formal vote was taken or resolution passed by the ministers, but the line advocated by Ben-Gurion and Shertok that the refugees should not be allowed back had become Israeli policy. Orders immediately went out during the IDF chains of command to bar the return of refugees. During the following weeks, again and again, orders reached the brigades manning the lines to prevent a return, also with live fire." Unquote. For many accounts of Israeli history, the story begins approximately where this one is going to end. On May 15, 1948, the British officially evacuated and Israel declared statehood. Within hours, the Arab armies invaded the new Jewish state, which was surrounded by enemies on all sides. For decades, the Israeli, North American, and European historiography held that the Palestinians had left Palestine at the urging of radio broadcasts from the Arab armies. When the Arabs failed to massacre the Jews, the history explains, the Palestinians were unable to return and became refugees. The massacres of Palestinians that occurred were isolated instances or accidental in nature. In reality, these radio broadcasts have never been documented, and the scholarship of IDF military archives reveals hundreds of expulsions of villages. Over 700,000 Palestinians would be expelled or flee in response of news of massacres, over half of the population. Over 700 Palestinians would be expelled or flee in response of news of massacre, over half the population. The ethnic cleansing of Palestine was well underway by the time the Arab armies entered Palestine, with nearly 300,000 refugees by May 14th. Another large round of expulsions occurred on the first day of Israel's existence. Yishuv was also far more prepared for war than most accounts admit. While the Jewish population of Palestine was outnumbered 2-1, the Yishuv held advantages in most other departments. Benny Morris writes, quote, "The Yishuv enjoyed advantages over the Palestinian Arabs and all other indices of strength. National organization for war, trained manpower, weaponry, weapons production, morale and motivation, and above all, command and control. Moreover, the Yishuv enjoyed a demographic advantage in army-age males, resulting in part from the deliberate policy during the previous years, bringing in as many young male immigrants as possible." Morris continues to describe the Yishuv as a highly literate, industrialized, and cohesive political entity, in contrast to the divided, agricultural, and disorganized Palestinian masses, still reeling from the massive setbacks to their movement since the 1936-39 rebellion. The Yishuv also enjoyed a strong international network of support. In the first 3 months of 1948, Golda Meir raised $50 million for the Haganah, double her goal, followed by another $50 million in May to June. The Palestinians had support from various less generous Arab states, who provided the Palestinians with a number of outdated, unserviceable, or incompatible weapons. Ultimately, Benny Morris cites the far superior network of supply and mobility of the Yishuv as the major decisive factor in the eventual Israeli victory, both during the Civil War phase and the war with the Arab armies. After May 15th, the new Israeli state consolidated its advanced militia into a proper national military, the Israel Defense Forces. The IDF still had a disadvantage in armor and heavy weapons, which was increasingly important due to the military intervention of the Arab armies. However, they were gradually arming themselves with tanks, artillery, half-tracks, anti-tank and aircraft guns, and other proper military equipment from Czechoslovakia. By the end of May, Israel had its first combat aircraft. Had the Arab armies been well supplied and cohesive, this might not have mattered. By the end of May, Arab forces in Palestine numbered less than 28,000, a mixture of Egyptians, Jordanians, Syrians, Iraqis, and a small number of Lebanese and Palestinian irregulars. Again, aside from a small number of elite formations such as the Arab Legion, most of these units were under-equipped and poorly coordinated. By mid-July, the IDF numbered 65,000 troops. By early spring 1949, 115,000. In late 1948 and early 1949, Arab forces were at their height, numbering no more than 60,000. Most critically of all, Israel benefited from various arms embargoes that disproportionately affected the Arab armies. Within 2 months of arrival, the Arab army supplies were dwindling while Israel continued to rapidly build its military power. In Benny Morris's words, the Arab states lacked the cash or the contacts for the Czech arms dealers supplying Israel. At the start of the Arab attack, the Iraqi Air Force consisted of 62 aircraft, only three of which were modern. By October 1948, the Israeli Air Force achieved air superiority over Palestine, despite only consisting of a few dozen combat aircraft. Despite Arab bluster and rhetoric warning of a momentous massacre, the Arab armies were badly defeated by 1949. Only 150,000 Palestinians remained in their homes within the borders of what was now the State of Israel. Over 700,000 refugees were spread out throughout Gaza, now controlled by Egypt, the West Bank, now controlled by Jordan, as well as Lebanon and Syria. The ethnic cleansing of Palestine became known as the Nakba, Arabic for catastrophe. Before the war ended, and all throughout the following years, Palestinians would attempt to cross the border back to their homes and land, only to be met with live fire. Some who successfully crossed and returned were subsequently expelled. The Palestinians remaining inside Israel would live under military rule until 1966. Israel moved to further cement the new Jewish majority by encouraging Jews worldwide to immigrate en masse. The Jews of the Middle East and North Africa would immigrate or flee in massive numbers over the next two decades. Anti-Semitic violence would occasionally flare up starting in the 40s and beyond, with the status of Jews becoming even more precarious after the 47-49 war. In 1948, nearly a million Jews lived in the Arab nations, Iran, and Turkey. Between 1948 and 1959, 260,000 of these Jews entered Israel, mostly from Iraq, Yemen, and Libya. By 1972, 900,000 Jews of the Middle East and North Africa had left their homes. Two-thirds had gone to Israel, and the rest to the United States and Europe. The reasons for the exodus are numerous: a combination of coercion and incentive, fear of repression, and the promise of economic opportunity. Some even believed that the messianic times were fast approaching. The waves of immigrations happened at different times in vastly different countries, a topic that would make a podcast series of its own. Nonetheless, it's important to address the canard of the double Nakba, a concept employed by apologists for the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Tom Segev writes, quote, "Deciding to emigrate to Israel was often a very personal decision. It was based on the particular circumstances of the individual's life. They were not all poor or dwellers in dark caves and smoking pits, nor were they always subject to persecution, repression, or discrimination in their native lands. They emigrated for a variety of reasons, depending on the country, the time, the community, and the person." Unquote. In a study of Jewish immigration to early Israel, Devorah Hakohen notes that a faction of the Zionist movement opposed a Knesset plan to bring in 600,000 immigrants in 4 years, doubling the Jewish population. While the plan was adopted, opponents had argued that taking in such a large number of Jews could not be justified for those whose lives were not in danger. At the end of the day, however, the majority of these Jews lost their property and wealth, left with little to nothing upon leaving their homes. The already poor Palestinian Jews were now swelled by poor Jews from all over the Middle East and North Africa. The exodus ultimately left bitter feelings towards their former neighbors, particularly the Arabs. The role of Middle Eastern Jews in mediation was largely destroyed by these developments, further cementing a sectarian split between Jews and non-Jews. Economic conditions remain difficult for Middle Eastern Jews in Israel, however, with racist attitudes continuing to persist amongst Ashkenazi Jews to the present day. The double Nakba argument continues the long Zionist tradition of ignoring the plight of Jews of color except when useful against Arabs. David Ben-Gurion became the first prime minister of Israel, a post he held for the bulk of the next two decades. His Labor Zionist Party, Mapai, was the dominant force in Israeli politics and the major predecessor to the Labor Party, which would remain the ruling party without interruption until 1977. Among the list of prime ministers of Israel were Yigal Alon, the architect of the psychological warfare campaign threatening rape and slaughter on the residents of Hula Valley, and Menachem Begin, who gave the order to bomb the King David Hotel, as well as Yitzhak Shamir, among the top three leaders of the Lehi Stern Gang. With the creation of the Israel Defense Forces came the absorption of the Irgun and Lehi into the Haganah Military Command. The IDF would fight a series of wars over the next few decades against the Arab states, Palestinian resistance groups, and the Palestinian civilian population. While previous generations of Palestinian politics were dominated by the same elite families of Palestine, this new generation of Palestinian intellectuals and revolutionary looked to Algeria as the ideal model of anti-colonial struggle. The militants of Algeria had successfully driven out one of the most powerful imperial powers of Europe, the French. This new generation would look to the rising liberation movements of Africa, Asia, and Latin America as their inspiration, as well as to the Islamic preacher-turned-guerrilla, Izz al-Din al-Qassam. The Nakba had completely turned Palestinian society upside down. Palestinian capital's monopoly on politics was destroyed along with the old Palestine. This would open up space for Palestinians of different classes and backgrounds to emerge as the leaders of the future Palestinian national movement, which bore little resemblance to the national movement dominated by the Nashashibis and Husseini families. Khalil al-Sakakini would resettle in Egypt, never to return home. His family were among the last holdouts to leave Kadamon during the major offensives of April 1948. His son Sari, whose birthday had been interrupted by the first bombs dropped by the British in Jerusalem as a child, died suddenly of a heart attack in 1953. The elder Sakakini was devastated and died a few months later. Sakakini had documented a life of contradictions, bitter anger, and compassion. At one point in time, he'd risked his own life to hide a Jewish man fleeing likely execution, maintaining a friendship with Alter Levine for years after their release. At another period of his life, he hoped Hitler would weaken the British and prevent the Jews from taking over Palestine. Sakakini would also object to allowing displaced persons from the Nazi concentration camps into Palestine. And yet again, in the middle of a war zone with bombs falling around him, his entire world falling apart, he demanded face to face to his own side's leadership a purity of arms in the face of a ruthless enemy, the combined forces of the Zionist movement, a political movement that aimed to rid Palestine of Palestinians for years before the first major bursts of anti-Jewish violence. Today, the Palestinian people number approximately 12 million. 1.7 million live as second-class citizens in Israel. 4.7 million live under an apartheid system of rule in the West Bank. 1.8 million live in the largest open-air prison in the world, the Gaza Strip, frequently subjected to destructive wars and blockaded by Israel. The rest live in refugee camps and diaspora communities all over the world, in the United States, Chile, Jordan, and so on. The ethnic cleansing of Palestine peaked in 1948, but smaller-scale transfer or the massacre of Palestinians continued and still continues to occur. Many of these families still have keys to their old homes, many of which no longer exist, with entire towns replaced by forests or Jewish homes bearing no mention of the Palestinians who lived there previously. Khalil al-Sakakini lost many things in 1948. Tom Segev describes his sorrow. Quote, "Every time I recall that horrible hour when we left our house like thieves in the night, with shells falling around us and bullets flying over our heads," he wrote a few months later, "I hit myself and think, how could we have forgotten to take all the bottles in the cupboard?" He imagined the Jewish soldiers finding his liquor and saying that a good drink made all the fighting worthwhile. He had forgotten his nargila as well. but above all, he mourned the loss of his books. "Are you safe, my books?" he wrote. "I don't know what your fate was after we left. Were you ruined? Were you burned? Were you respectfully transferred to a library, public or private? Or did you end up at a corner grocery store, your pages wrapped around onions?" Unquote. The Movements is a leftist history and politics podcast. Music by Amel Mathluthi. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Movements Pod, and support the show by donating at patreon.com/movementspod.